I'm Terry Powell, Community Relations Officer at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. I'd like to welcome you here this evening and welcome you to Science at the Theater, sponsored by Berkeley Lab Friends of Science, and co-sponsored, and I want to thank our co-sponsored by the University of California, Berkeley, Chabot Space and Science Center, the Exploratorium, and the science departments of Berkeley, Albany, and Oakland High Schools. Dr. Stephen Chu received an A.B. in math and a B.S. in physics from the University of Rochester in 1970 and completed his Ph.D. in physics at the University of California, Berkeley in 1976. From 1978 to 1987, he worked at Bell Laboratories, where he conducted the research that later led to his 1997 Nobel Prize in physics, which he shared with Claude Cohen-Tanucci and William Phillips for methods to cool and trap atoms with laser light. For the next 17 years, he was professor of physics and applied physics at Stanford University, where he more recently oversaw the creation of the BioX program, a multidisciplinary initiative linking the physical and biological sciences with engineering and medicine. In August 2004, Dr. Chu returned to the University of California as the sixth director of Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory and as a UC Berkeley professor of physics and molecular and cell biology. Since arriving at Berkeley, he has shown an inviting, warm, friendly, and intense inquisitiveness about the world's climate change and its energy problems. He has become a nationally and internationally recognized proponent and thought leader on the need to address the security, climate, and economic impacts of our dependence on carbon-emitting energy sources. In 2005, he co-authored the National Academy's report, Rising Above the Gathering Storm, Energizing and Employing America for a Brighter Economic Future. He is also co-chair for the forthcoming Inter-Academy Council study, Transitions to Sustainable Energy Systems, due out this fall to identify global transitions to an adequately affordable, sustainable, clean energy supply. The scientific evidence is clear. The Earth's climate is warming, largely through our use of fossil fuels. In response to the global warming crisis, which he has called the greatest challenge facing science today, Steve Chu has established the Helios Project at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, an aggressive scientific initiative to transform existing and future energy technologies away from fossil fuels and into those that are renewable and do not emit greenhouse gases. Please welcome Dr. Stephen Chu.
Thank you, Terry. I hope you'll forgive me, I have a bit of a cold, and so I might break out in a coughing rash. The other thing is you must be warned that the extreme right-hand part of my slides doesn't show, I guess, because we're in Berkeley. But but in any case, I know, it's terrible. I'm pleased to be here to talk about something I do care about very much. And in fact, it was a large part of why I joined the Berkeley Lab. And that is, we have an energy problem and we can do something about it. This is a far-ranging talk, but let me just begin by saying that energy affects many sectors, many things of concern, both nationally and internationally, because national and international security is intimately tied now to energy security. So is economic prosperity and the environmental stewardship. These are all intimately tied. So let me give you a few samples. This is the amount of money we spent on importing fossil fuels as a function of time from 1970 to 2005. And the integrated amount of money we spent in 2005 was $250 billion importing fossil fuel. Since many of us don't spend $250 billion, I wanted to compare it to another big number. The entire U.S. federal discretionary, that is, you take out Social Security, Medicaid, other things, and the military expenditures, and you're left with $440 billion. So, and projecting forward into the future, you know, it could go up and down, but I think there's wide-scale agreement that 10, 20 years in the future, this number will grow unless we do something about it. So there's an economic issue here. The United States is importing, pushing 60% of its oil from abroad. Let me remind you that as late as 1970, the United States was an oil exporting country and used to be the biggest oil producer in the world. China has also followed in the United States' footsteps, but much more rapidly. So in the early 1990s, it went from oil exporting to oil importing, and now is importing over half of its oil. And so as China develops, as India develops, as other countries develop, there's a headlong clash as to trying to guarantee access to future oil supplies. And this becomes a largely defining issue with regard to geopolitics. So that's another issue we have to be concerned about. The Earth's climate is changing. The last 2006 IPCC report says that it's changing and it's greater than 90% probable that the change is caused by humans. This is in marked contrast to what happened 15 years ago, where the IPCC said there is no evidence, hard evidence, that any changes we see in climate are due to humans. So it's really been turned around in the last 15 years. What is the basis of this? Let me just give you one snapshot. This is the concentration of greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide, methane, nitrous oxide, going back from the year 1000 to year 2000. And so it's pretty stable, and all of a sudden there are these big upticks. So what's happening? Well, what happened is the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. So if you will buy the fact that this uptick is due to the burning of beginning with coal, but later coal, oil, natural gas, and other fossil fuel sources, that this is human-caused, then you can actually try to parse out what is caused by humans and what is caused by natural effects, for example, solar variations, volcanoes, and other things. So the red line is what we've observed over the last 150 years in terms of average temperature increase in the Earth. And the gray line is, this is circa about year 2000, the best computer models we had. And if you put in all the variations that we knew about that were caused by nature, like volcanoes, which actually causes a cooling, you find that you cannot get the computer model, the gray hash, to actually agree with the observed temperature increase. But if you stick in what I just showed you, the carbon dioxide, nitrous oxide, methane, then you get some reasonable agreement. So it's evidence like this that's highly suggestive that that what we see is caused by humans. And there are many other things of that nature. Okay, so let's take that there's a reasonably high probability that the climate is changing and that humans caused it. And so what's really important is not that it's changing, but what its future effects will be. And so I'm going to give you a few predictions, but I want also to impress upon you the fact that predictions are, by their very nature, not 100% reliable. And for that, I remind you of what the great American philosopher of the 20th century said about this. That's Yogi Berra. He said many wise things, but the thing that I want to remind you is that predictions are hard to make, especially about the future. And so that... So you warm up by predicting the past. He didn't say that part, but that previous graph I showed you of can you model what actually happened is a prediction of the past. So with that, there have been significant predictions in terms of climate change. We already see increased damage from floods, storms, wildfires, and we do see sea levels rising, and there are predicted to be large population displacements. spreads of massive species extinction, increased species extinction, spread of disease, anything that's temperature, waterborne, malaria, cholera, dengue fever, and other things would you can add to this list. But I want to focus on one, namely water shortages, just to give you a sample of what we're worried about. This is taken from a paper from the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. It's a very highly respected referee journal. And it gives predictions about what will happen in California based on two scenarios. B1 is a very optimistic scenario. It says we will control our carbon emissions, our greenhouse gas emissions, and we will keep the level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere down to below 500 parts per million. For those of you who know these numbers, we're at 380 now, and that is very optimistic. Kyoto was shooting for something like 550 parts per million, and I personally think we probably would exceed this. The A1 prediction is a prediction based on business as usual, increased energy efficiency, but no concerted worldwide effort to decrease carbon emissions. So what does it predict? The amount of Sahara snowpack would decrease in the optimistic scenario between 30 and 70% in this century. That the alpine and subalpine forests, these forests and that snowpack is a large part of our water storage system during the wet season, so it meters it out during the drier seasons, factor 2 to factor 4. At the A1 scenario, you're really seeing vanishing of both. And in this paper, I bring out a sentence, an understated sentence, saying this could fundamentally disrupt California's water rights system. If you can imagine 2 years in a row of 50% decrease in Sahara snowpack, this actually happened when I was a graduate student and postdoc at Berkeley in the late 70s, and there was severe water rationing. For just 2 years of this, but we're talking about forever. And so, very large error bars. This might be manageable, 30%, 90% is not manageable. So this is of great concern. So this is one of several predictions. This is now a measurement. This is the average glacial thickness around the world. This is not only going to be hitting California, but it's actually hitting around the world. And so the average glacial thickness is now shrinking by roughly a meter a year. And this is particularly troublesome in the Tibetan snow plateau, the Himalayas, because the Himalayas, the water runoff from the Himalayas, supplies water to roughly a third of the people in the world, because it supplies water to India, Pakistan, China. So this is, again, one of these things that we're very worried about, internationally as well as nationally. Another thing is that the long-term effects of putting this slug of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere are not well understood. This is one particular model. I'll say it's particularly pessimistic, but here we are today. We get hold of our carbon emissions. There's a worldwide concerted effort, and you bring this down dramatically by factors of 10 or 20. Carbon dioxide, once in the atmosphere, it circulates between the land and the oceans, but the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere becomes rather stable. And the natural carbon sequestration that occurs, how fast it will bring back the carbon dioxide before the Industrial Revolution is not known. And there is a big debate about this, but the debate is it might take a few hundred years or a few thousand years. It's not that it's going to take 10 years or 20 years or 50 years. And so what we do today and what we do to the century is we'll have an impact that would last centuries or perhaps millennia. So that's this curve is the carbon dioxide, and this is the rise in temperature. There's already about a 1.5 degree increase rise in temperature that would have been caused by humans if we shut off all carbon emissions today by humans. And so it's built into the system. And there, here again, you see this continuing increase in the temperature long after the CO2 emissions has declined. So this is another reason why we shouldn't wait and be 99.9% sure that these things will happen. I think even at 90% or, quite frankly, 80%, it's prudent risk management to work hard about this issue. This is a graph of the wealth per person in various countries, as and plotted on the y-axis is the energy use. And here in the United States, this is time sequence. We're the energy and wealth leader in the world. Australia is trying to catch us. Canada is also. European countries, Japan, are actually about a factor two less in energy consumption per amount of wealth. So this is actually an indication that wealth is not directly proportional to energy consumption. You can be a factor of two lower. In fact, many of the EU countries and Japan want to bring this level down by another factor of two. So the y-axis is quite interesting. This is in the amount of energy per person per year in billions of joules of energy. And a joule is something that most people don't really have a good feel for. So I decided to translate into this into something else that people would understand, some other unit of energy and wealth. Well, in the days before the Industrial Revolution, the amount of wealth you had is totally shown by the amount of servants, or earlier by the number of slaves you have. So what is 350 billion joules per year equivalent to? It's, you just count up the number of calories a human being needs. It's 2,000, you add 500 because they've got to do some work. And so that means that every man, woman, and child in the United States has 100 energy servants working for them. And the average person in China now has 10. So now you might ask, as the world population grows to a peak of somewhere shy of 10 billion people, can the entire world sustain this bit of energy consumption, let's say at the United States? And the answer, I think, is no, but that is actually not the right question to ask. It's really, what's the carbon footprint and what are the other sustainable things that go into this type of energy consumption? And I actually believe, but this is more a statement of faith than any hard calculation, that the entire world, 10 billion people, can have 100 energy servants working for them if it's done in the correct way. Because it's really the carbon emissions that's the issue. So it is possible to have great wealth, but you don't have to ruin the world in the meantime. As was mentioned, I'm co-chair of this report. The Inter-Academy Council is a council that represents over 90 academies of sciences around the world. And Jose Goldenberg and I are the co-chairs of this, and the membership of about 20 people have been nominated by various academies around the world. And it's actually given me a greater international appreciation of energy problems in various countries. Jose Goldenberg, I should also say, is the architect of the Brazilian sugarcane ethanol industry. And right now, Brazil raises sugarcane, and 40% of the transportation, the personal transportation in Brazil, is from sugarcane, unsubsidized, and it's being done in an environmentally friendly way, in the sense that despite what you might hear from press, the sugarcane industry in Brazil, especially in São Paulo, where he is now the Minister of the Environment, and where most of the sugarcane is grown, is following, for example, United States Environmental Protection Agency rules. So it is possible to transition to something other than oil in an environmentally responsible way. Okay, so let me go to the solutions. I think you have to adopt a dual strategy, and you have to maximize energy efficiency. This remains the lowest hanging fruit today, and it will probably remain the lowest hanging fruit for the next couple of decades. And so maximizing energy efficiency and minimizing wasted energy is really should be our highest priority. But in the meantime, you can't conserve your way to this solution. You also have to develop new clean sources of energy. So now to the first issue, the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab has been a leader in it. For those of you who don't know where we are, We're in this little hill site overlooking the Berkeley campus. That's our famous stadium. It's a very distinguished laboratory. In its history, 11 employees have been awarded the Nobel Prize, and much more importantly, 9 of them did their work at the laboratory. And today we have roughly 3% of the total membership of the United States National Academy of Sciences. So it's a very, very distinguished laboratory. If you took the employees of the lab and just said they were another research university, and a university comparison is appropriate because there are over 600 students and postdocs, graduate students and postdocs, who are trained at the laboratory each year, we would probably be certainly in the top 10 or 15 universities in the country. California has been a leader in energy conservation. This is the electricity consumption per person in California from 1960 to 2004 or 2. I'm not sure where this one goes, but it's flat until 2005 as well. The rest of the United States, excluding California, would be up here, because California is roughly 10% of the population. So the rest of the United States consumed energy, had an energy increase, electricity increase of 60%. What happened in this time was that a very distinguished high-energy physicist, Art Rosenfeld, he was Enrico Fermi's last student, left high-energy physics in the first oil crisis, in the period of those long gasoline lines, and said, what can I do to help with the energy crisis? So he just simply walked away from high energy physics and turned his attention to the energy problem. And he found that the best thing he could do was to help California and the United States use energy more wisely. What do I mean by that? This is a very famous slide. This is plotted as a function of time. The energy use in refrigerators climbing into the middle of the 70s, and then remarkably started to decrease. The size of the refrigerator is also climbing, still increasing in proportion to American stomachs. 22 cubic feet is the average refrigerator today. It's asymptotically reaching a plateau because of the size of kitchen doors, but we'll fix that. So Art went into appliance stores and said, well, what about refrigerators? He looked at the cost of refrigerators for a given size. He looked at the prices and found that the efficiency, how much electricity they used, was only distantly related to price, really not at all. So you don't have to be a rocket scientist or an engineer in refrigerator technology to realize that the energy efficiency of the appliance had nothing to do with the cost. So he started with volunteer labeling, but convinced California to initiate a refrigerator energy standard, that all refrigerators had to go above a certain standard. And it increased, these standards increased over time. Now, you know something really unusual. The efficiency started to improve before the standard came into practice. Why is that? Because about that time, the appliance manufacturers were put on notice. You can't hide. Don't run to the Republicans. Don't run to the Democrats. You just can't hide from it, so start thinking about it. You know, transfer your resources from your lawyers to your engineers. Very, very... And so they started getting efficient beforehand, and it started to improve, and the efficiency has actually increased by more than a factor of 4. Now, during this time, not 40%, a factor of 4, even though the size went up. Now, during this time, there was all sorts of tales by industry saying the price of refrigerators would zoom through the roof if you did this. There was an initial uptick, but afterwards, they got better at engineering, and the price of refrigerators, inflation adjusted, went down by a factor of 2. This is something that actually has played itself over and over again. If there's a regulation that says you have to do something, whether it be putting in seat belts, catalytic converters, clean air for coal plants, clean water, so you have to treat sewage and industries can't dump raw sewage out into streams. The first tack that the lawyers use, among other things, and the companies use, is it's going to drive the electricity bill up, drive the cost of cars up, everything up. And it repeatedly has been demonstrated that once the engineers start thinking about it, it's actually far less than the original estimates. So I think we should remember that when we hear this again, because you will hear it again. Now, that's just refrigerators. How big a deal are refrigerators? So if we had the 1974 efficiency, but just now consider older refrigerators, this is data from 2001, this is the amount of electricity we would have used had there had the efficiency been flat of 1974 going forward in time. And this is how much we use today in refrigerators. So this is how much electricity we've saved. Okay, compare this to 50 million, you know, rooftop installations of PV, all the conventional hydropower in the United States, all the nuclear electricity generation in the United States, which is 20% of all electricity generation in the United States. So just refrigerators and freezers saved 3-4%. It's amazing. And this is also true to a lesser extent. There's only about a little less than a factor two improvement in air conditioners and things like that. So in California, the energy savings were divided between these appliance standards that Art Rosenfeld started, building standards, which he also started, higher insulation, double-paned windows, things of that nature. And another remarkable thing that most people don't appreciate, which is estimated to be half the savings, is that the profit motive of utility companies, which are actually privately held, they have to return profit to shareholders. Before, the profit motive is if you sell more energy, you make more money, and then you pass this on to the shareholders. So there was no system that says to a utility company, why don't you preach energy conservation? And so the state of California separated that profit motive from the utility companies, and it has been remarkable. That's why PG&E and Southern Edison in the South are the biggest profits of, or biggest expounders, if you will, of energy conservation. The cost of an energy audit or any energy conservation measure they put in place can be passed on to the consumers. And so they were actually encouraged to do this, and it worked wonders. We're the only state in the country that does this. The other states are beginning to do this, but it's amazing. This program has been going on for 17 years, and it's been widely successful based on what we just saw, that's why we are the leader in energy conservation in terms of electricity. Okay, so let me go to the supply side of the energy problem. Now, we have lots of fossil fuel. That's really both good and bad news. We won't run out of energy, but there's enough carbon in the ground to really cook us. Coal is my worst nightmare. Carbon emission in the next 30 years is predicted in the current forecast to, we'll be adding 3 times the amount of carbon dioxide in the previous history of all humanity if we continue on our present course. And there is abundant fossil fuel energy in these various forms. It's hard to really say. For example, in coal, it's so plentiful, there's no serious exploration for it. And coal is the default option in the US, China, and India. And why is that? It's also the default option of Russia. It's because 2/3 of the coal supply is in these countries. Now, so what's going on? Well, China is now embarked on a program to be building about a half a gigawatt to a gigawatt coal plant a week. United States, it's hard to say what the United States is doing, but if you believe the numbers in the New York Times and other papers, there are about 140, 150 applications for coal plants that have been applied for in the United States today. New coal plants, and let's assume that you don't apply for a coal plant to build a new coal plant unless you intend to build it in the next 3 years. So the United States is on a path that's also roughly one a week. It could be a little bit less, it could be one every 10 days because not all those plants would be built. So we're also on this path, and that is the default option. It is also the default option of India, Russia wants to go to coal because it uses its natural gas and oil as hard currency to keep its economy, or to restore its economy, really. So this is what we're seeing today. This is the default option that we are currently doing. It's not that we're going to head for this. We are doing it. There is a possibility that we could take the coal, gasify it, turn that gasification into a stream of hydrogen and CO2, pump the CO2 at very high pressures deep underground into this layer of, this is an underground salt water table. And so the idea is many thousands of times the atmospheric pressure, CO2 will be pumped down here. It initially displaces the salt water, but eventually the carbon dioxide dissolves in the salt water, and finally it diffuses to where you form little droplets of salty impregnated carbon dioxide water around little grains. And at that point, it's very, very secure, it's believed to be, because little microcapillary action will prevent it from being released. So, but there is a possibility, and this is of some concern, that in its initial state as a big bubble of gas, it might find its way to the surface, or in its state as a CO2 impregnated salt water, it's more acid, and it could also form some cracks. So the issue here is, and actually not the cost of converting the coal to a stream of hydrogen and CO2 and pumping underground. That would probably increase the power bill by as much as 25%. That's what a carbon price of $3 or $4 a ton would be equivalent to. But there's an unknown cost in that if this faces legal challenges, why would there be a legal challenge? Because there would be people who say, I don't want this done in my backyard, because if the carbon dioxide ever does bubble to the surface, it could actually kill people. 10% carbon dioxide is lethal. And so that's one of the issues. We are doing research in this sequestration, both at the lab and worldwide, but at a very small level, equivalent of a few million tons of carbon per year. And we have to go to several billion tons of carbon per year before it becomes a 10% effect. So it's a sort of a research development issue. So I think we have to do this if we're going to go forward with coal, but it's not a guarantee that we have a solution with coal. What about oil substitutes? Well, many of you may know that there are tar sands in Alberta, Canada, that if you use natural gas and you heat up steam and inject it deep into the ground, you can release some of these tar sands. This is a Google.Earth picture of one of these such pits, open pit mining in Alberta, Canada. This is the scale 5 miles. These are lakes and holding ponds. Lakes where you recover the tar, you separate the petroleum-like products from the icky stuff, and then you put the icky stuff in ponds, but the ponds are the size of lakes. What's a little scary about this is that so far there's no requirement that these companies put aside money for restoration of the environment. The other thing is that for every 4 units of energy you get out in the form of petroleum-like products, you're putting in 1 unit of energy, and so it's also much more highly polluting than conventional oil. So a lot of these things you can find in Google.Earth. Let me briefly talk about fission. I know it's dangerous to talk about nuclear fission at Berkeley, but because there are waste and nuclear proliferation issues that are not completely solved. I'll be very honest about that. But the waste, let me just take one, the waste issue, and compare it to coal. The requirements of long-term nuclear waste storage are that it's a very, very small fraction. I think it's like 5 or 10% of background in very remote areas. And so this is, let's say, in Yucca Mountain, where in perhaps a couple hundred thousand years, there might be a leak out that could be like 10% of background. Actually, burning coal releases radioactivity. It also releases sulfur dioxide, nitrous oxide, mercury, particulate matter, all sorts of things. By the way, those first things, the the sulfur dioxide and the nitrous oxide, the mercury, the particulate matter, are far more deadly than what I'm about to talk about. But coal plants release much more radioactivity than a nuclear plant, about 100 times more. And it's because of the trapped uranium, thorium, and other materials. That estimate of 100 times more is assuming that 99.5% of all the fly ash that's released is actually captured and not released into the atmosphere. That fly ash actually finds its way into the system as well, but I'm discounting that. And so, but if you include the mining, fuel processing, and everything else, it's still one quarter of coal radioactive emissions. But we don't actually know what the total radiation exposure is to all the stuff from coal burning. So again, coal is my worst nightmare. So if you're concerned about radiation, coal might be worse than a nuclear reactor. It's worse in every other respect. Okay. So wind. So here's some good news. This is relatively clean, very clean, compared to the other fossil fuels. And the price of wind electricity generation from wind has gone down by about a factor of 10 in the last 20 years. These are engineering marvels. The biggest wind generators today have a capacity of 3 million watts generation. The wingspan is the size of a 747. The newer ones have a wingspan of 1.25 soccer fields. So these are huge things, and they are actually competitive with natural gas-fired plants. Actually, that isn't that good, because we don't build natural gas-fired plants anymore. We build cogen plants of generating both electricity and heat with using natural gas, but the price of natural gas has gone up so much that that's why we're defaulting very rapidly to coal. So this is a good thing. A not so good thing is that wind is transient and we have no method for storing electricity. So either you use it or lose it. And the other not so good thing, or good thing depending on your point of view, is that the best wind sites in black and dark blue are where there are not many people. And so you have to transport this energy across great distances. Now, I should tell you an anecdote, and I don't know if I had anything to do with this, but it's a story where I was giving some advice to the Secretary of Treasury and the head of the Economic Council, Al Hubbard, and Secretary Paulson, who are actually very strong conservation advocates within the administration. And it was a little thing of four or five people. The Secretary of Energy, Bodman, was there, and we were in this little small room. And I was supposed to be briefing them on biofuels, but I made some mention of electricity transmission, that all transient sources of electricity, like wind and solar energy, would become much more valuable if you can transport the electricity over great distances. But we have no interstate transmission system for electricity. We have a local grid, just as we have a local road that takes us from New York to Chicago. But until there was an interstate highway system, we didn't have an interstate system. Why? Because Chicago and New York taxpayers didn't want to pay for roads that connected across states. And I said the magic word to Paulson. I said, and you know what? It won't cost the taxpayers anything. And he really got interested. And I said, all you have to do is let the utility... the burden of putting transmission lines used to fall strict on the shoulders of utility companies. And I said, why not share the load so that the energy users would also have to pony up for that, just as the trucking industry and the automotive users ponied up for the money that paid for the interstate highway system. And last week, I actually read in the papers that that's happening. Unfortunately, it means that your electricity bill might go up a tenth of a cent per kilowatt hour, maybe less. That means that people in various states who import electricity from afar actually will start to pay for some of this. And so in that circumstance, we could see a long-distance efficient electricity transmission line. Also very important for blackouts, because it's the synchronization of the AC in various parts of the country that actually cause some of the blackouts. So if you can transport electricity from direct current from, let's say, over here to over here. And then you synchronize it exactly when you pull it down to the local grid. That would be make the country more much more robust against blackouts. So it has a lot of good things. And it looks like it's going to happen. It's amazing. I don't know if I had anything to do with it, but it certainly got Poulsen interested. Let me talk about solar cells, photovoltaic, solar, biomass, and energy storage. As was mentioned by Terry Powell, when I took the job about 2¾ years ago to become director of Berkeley Lab, part of the intent was to see if I could get some of the very best basic scientists to be interested in turning their attention to harnessing the sun's energy and converting the solar energy into various forms of energy like electricity, but a large part of it would be conversion of that energy into fuel for transportation. The reason for this is because this is our most expensive form of energy, and it's the one where you see the balance of payments doing what it is, and because we are currently forced to buy oil from a lot of people who don't really like us. And wouldn't it be nice to have a substitute that could be grown at home? And so there are various pathways to this, and so let me walk you through two of them. The other issue is that if you could generate electricity economically competitively, you have to use it unless you can store it. So if you can store it in some form of chemical energy and then reclaim that to generate electricity on demand, then wind could be 15-20% of the electricity generation of the United States, and it can be baseload generation. Now, Denmark is right now 20% wind power. That means their entire electricity, 20% is coming from wind. They would like to go to 50%. So how can they do this? Well, they actually are entering into energy trading agreements with, for example, Sweden. So when the wind blows, they sell electricity to Sweden. When the wind doesn't blow, Sweden lets water through a dam and generates hydroelectric power. And so it's that trading agreement and long-distance transmission that will enable the storage of energy. So I think this is going to be a coming thing for many countries. Excuse me. This is as a function of, these are so-called learning curves. So this is the cost of various forms of energy in proportion to how much money has been invested in these forms of energy and also, of course, time from 1981 to 1995 for photovoltaics. Gas, the learning curve, the cost has gone up because the cost of natural gas has gone up. Windmills are about down here and photovoltaics are about here. This is a Moore's Law sort of thing, and one of the fascinating things about technology is that when you are on one of these Moore's Law's curves, this exponential improvement, the slope is, it could be faster, it could be slow, but once you're on these things, if you stay on this, the same technology, it's very rare that you get off. The only way you get off is if it plateaus. And I don't know why it is, but it just happens to be that way. So, for example, for solar photovoltaics, this is a learning curve for silicon, and we need to go down by roughly a factor of 10 before it can be wide-scale deployed without subsidy. Solar thermal is actually better for larger scale generation than photovoltaics, but photovoltaics can be used on rooftops or the tops of Walmart or Kmart or something like that, whereas solar thermal actually is installed, but none of these things would exist. Well, that's not true. A very small fraction of people have them on their roofs, but there's a large subsidies for this. And you can ask, in the United States, at the current cost of electricity, you would need about a factor 3 reduction in photovoltaics before people begin to think of sticking them on their roofs. Outside of Berkeley, and the utility companies would need a factor of 10 because there's actually a subsidy already built in because you get to sell electricity back to PG&E at retail rates, but retail rates are about a factor of 2.5 higher than wholesale rates. So there is already a subsidy in there. They don't care if it's, you know, a fraction of a percent, but at a couple of percent, 10%, 20%, then you really have to start redoing things. But it's okay because we've decoupled profit from selling energy. Here it's, but you need about a factor 10, and because of the transient nature, you might even need a little bit more. Because wind, as I said before, is actually comparable to cogen gas, but it's still discounted by utility companies by roughly a factor of 2 because of its transient nature. Just to tantalize you on how important it is that we get these factors of 3 or 10, or you let the price of electricity go up by a factor of 10, which I think most Americans aren't willing to do, you only need 0.2 to 0.3% of the world's desert to generate all the electricity needs at 20% efficiency. So, so the world's desert, you know, it's actually not that unsightly compared to just desert. So, this is something that's out there in front of us as a challenge to scientists and technologists. This is one example. I'm sorry to get technical, but this is one of many very good ideas that have come out of the Berkeley Lab and are current proposals for government funding. This is a little nanoparticle. You can think of it as a kind of a big, gigantic molecule. And in this big, gigantic molecule, light hits it in the form of a quanta of light, creates an electron, and another hole, an absence of electron called a hole. So the electrons go one way, the hole goes the other way. And so this giant organic molecule actually separates these two charges. And if one can develop a way to increase the conductivity and make a good electrical conduction connection between the ends of this nanoparticle and these electrodes, one can, in principle, make a very efficient photovoltaic cell using wet chemistry, not too rare elements, and these are very, very thin layers of the scale 50 or 100, 500,000 atoms. so now, if ideas like this work, it could transform the industry. What's the chance that a particular idea like this might work? Well, it could be 2%, 3%, or something like that. But there's a portfolio of these ideas, and I think the hope is that in the next 5 or 10 years, one or several of these might come home to roost. So this is the idea that rather than in, at least for as far as Lawrence Berkeley Lab and University of California, Berkeley are concerned, we don't want to improve upon manufacturing methods of silicon photocells. We'd rather chase after totally new approaches. The object is to generate something that ideally wet chemistry or some thin vapor film could be deposited on ideally a flexible, but a reel-to-reel process where you make this stuff the way you would print newspaper. And if you can do it that way, then the price could come down by an order of magnitude or more. Another area that we've become very interested in is to develop a biofuel approach to replacing petroleum. And you may know that BP, which is formerly British Petroleum, has teamed up with the University of California, Berkeley, and the Berkeley Lab and University of Illinois to fund a biosciences institute. And so the idea is that they would be investing $500 million over 10 years for these partners to do research in collaboration with BP. The vast majority of this research would be open, published stuff. But BP is also looking for, in the long run, a new business that is it possible that biofuels could be the equivalent of a new wellhead. So they're looking to long term. We have also applied for a grant from the Department of Energy. These are our partners, Sandia, Livermore, Berkeley, Stanford, and Davis with Lawrence Berkeley Lab. So this is an equivalent thing that complements the work that will be done in BP that hopefully will be funded by the Department of Energy. And this would be $25 million a year for the first 5 years, and we'll see if we get that. The idea is that we convert sunlight, carbon dioxide, water, and some nutrients into some biomass stuff, mostly in the form of cell wall material, and then you convert that cellulose type of material into chemical energy in the form of transportation fuel. And we would be working on all aspects of this total conversion, from breeding better plants to make more efficient use of water, sunlight, nutrients, and also, and this is the most important part, decreasing the cost and investment in energy in converting the cellulose into chemical energy. So the one thing is there enough land to go around to feed the country and the world, and also make a significant dent on a petroleum substitute? So this is a table I took out of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. In 1982, there were 420 million acres under cultivation in the U.S. It's since, in 2003, it's dropped to 370 million. The amount of rangeland and pasture land has also decreased. And there has been an amount of land, 30 million acres, put into a long-range conservation program. It's mostly in the form of pasture rangeland. All told, 75 million acres has been taken out of production because of the ability to produce far more food per acre in the United States. That's why there's a small fraction of that acreage was turned into condominiums, but most of it is overproduction. Some of it has been put into long-range conservation preserve, and what this means is that we pay farmers over a long period of time not to plant, but in a lot of the stuff that's taken on production more recently, we pay them on a year-to-year basis. So there's right now, the agricultural subsidies in the United States vary, but it's sizable. And it's been, if you look over the last 5 or 8 years, it's been something like $20 billion. In the future, there'll be tens of millions of more acres pulled out of production because world trade agreements will say we shouldn't be selling heavily subsidized crops on the open market. So there's actually a potential for at least tens of millions of acres of surplus land in the United States. Surprisingly, this is also true in most industrialized countries that have sensible agriculture. I emphasize the word sensible because Japan actually raises a lot of rice still. But you know, Canada, France, developed countries actually have huge agricultural surpluses. The production, agriculture production in the world has also increased, and this is the amount of cropland put under cultivation in the world. So this productivity is actually worldwide. It's not just the United States. So especially in marginal areas, that is to say areas that don't get that much water, one can look towards biofuels as a potential solution, the marginal land which would not grow food very well. This is an example of a plant that we would be interested in using. This is called miscanthus. So this is a graduate student of a colleague of ours at University of Illinois. I don't know her name, but the colleague's name is Steve Long. And these are, I've been told she's 5'3". There's another picture of someone up here that's a basketball player. But this is 12, 14 feet high. This is the amount of grass that grows in one growing season, unirrigated, unfertilized. The yield in this patch of grass per acre is 10 times the amount of ethanol that you can produce from corn. Okay, so that's why this is so tantalizing. Corn is not the right crop, and if you're looking at a factor of 5 or 10 improvement, then you're actually looking at having a very small dent in food prices, as well as just using surplus land. The great thing about these grasses is that they're perennials, which means you harvest the tops, the roots are still alive, it grows back the following year like a weed with a vengeance. They actually are weeds. So you don't have to till the soil for 10 or 15 years, and then it makes sense to perhaps plant a new weed. Because the roots are in the soil for a long time, they can establish symbiotic interactions with bacteria that fix nitrogen. So a large part of the fertilizer is actually taken care of. And many of these perennials, just before harvest time, they actually, because they're in it for the long haul, perennial means forever, they actually withdraw a lot of the mineral and precious nutrients from above the soil, gathering sunlight to the roots, because the top part dies off. Compared with switchgrass, which is another perennial, not as good as this miscanthus by about a factor of two, you have 1/8 the nitrogen runoff, 1/100 the soil erosion of corn. So it would be much better in terms of, better in order of magnitude in terms of oil, water use, et cetera. So it's better in all respects in terms of sustainability of the agriculture for energy. So that's why it's so desirable to work with these plants. So why aren't we doing this today? Well, it's because if you look at what these plants are made of, it's made of cellulose and hemicellulose. These are long chains of sugars, and you see that a large fraction of these sugars that we know how to convert into ethanol, but those sugars are protected by another set of molecules called lignin. And this lignin, or these blue guys, are complicated molecules that have been designed by plants to protect the plant against an onslaught of microbes, bacteria, or fungi. We already know that if we alter the genetic makeup of the lignin, there's different types of lignin, you can recover twice as much sugar. We can probably design, or very likely design, lignin that's easier to break down and other things. So, but in the short term, this essentially unimproved weed is great. It's already a factor of 5 or 10 better than corn. I should say that the lignin does such a good job of protecting plants that some of it, even after the plant dies, some of it gets fossilized. And it's believed, this is time, going back hundreds of millions of years, that 310 million years ago, some entrepreneurial plant invented lignin that spread, and that was the beginning of coal deposits. And it protected the plant so well that it could, a very small fraction of it could be fossilized. And so I've been told also, I'm not an expert in this by any means, but oil actually degrades in high temperatures and pressure. And so you see this kind of decay curve of oil. This could be noise. I'm not really sure what's going on here. So the moral is that if you don't use up our oil in 140 million years, it will decay. So we're going to fix that. We're going to use up in 200 years. So what's the hang-up? Why aren't we growing these set of weeds? The reason is that once you have the feedstock is essentially free. There's a lot of bio waste in the form of corn stover and also wheat straw, and in Asia rice straw, also cellulose materials. In the U.S., you're beginning to be forbidden to burn this stuff, and so farmers have to pay people to haul it away and become landfill, which is where the microbes turn it into carbon dioxide and methane. So the first pass is going to be free. So what's the hang-up? The hang-up is that it costs a lot of money to convert the cellulose into energy. You have to invest a lot of energy. You use either hot acid, steam pre-treatments, hot steam that tries to separate the lignin from the sugars. After you do that, it's not a good state. You have to kind of calm the stuff down, get rid of the acid, get rid of the harsh alkalis, the other stuff. Sprinkle it with a set of enzymes, which is the most costly. And then after the enzymes break down the complex sugars into simple sugars, then you ferment it the way you would make wine or beer. And at 12-14% alcohol, the ethanol kills the yeast. So, and then you have to expend more energy to separate the ethanol from the water. So this whole process, and especially the enzymes, are the real rub in these very high costs for converting cellulose into ethanol, whereas Brazilian sugarcane is now roughly 90 cents a gallon. Without subsidy, it's competitive with gasoline. It's better than competitive with gasoline. So the object is to bring it down to a parity with sugarcane or better. This is an example of a pilot type of plant. And the, as I said before, the biggest energy and cost gains would be in terms of improving the fuel production, breaking down the cellulose lignin into just simple sugars and separating this stuff. This is what we have today. Here's another cellulose refinery. It's in the form of a termite that eats your home. It's another billion-dollar, multi-billion-dollar industry. So what happens as the termite eats your house, it doesn't actually have the capacity to turn your house into energy directly. So it enters into a pact with microbes that live in the various guts of the termite. This is a gut of a termite. And in these guts, these various stomach regions, there are microbial communities that break down the cellulose. They turn it into a chemical fuel. They take a little carrying charge, but pass a lot of it on to the termite with instructions, go get me more wood. So it's a very happy situation for everybody except the homeowner. So what we're doing is we're sequencing the DNA of these microbes. And we're partnering with a small company in Southern California called Diversa, which goes around the world looking for hungry termites, to see if we can find out whether there are better microbial communities that break down the cellulose. We also want to go into Brazilian rainforests where there's rapid turnover of biomass and go prospecting for other microbes and microbial communities to sequence the genomes of these microbes and to find out what magical enzymes they're using to break down this. And so the idea is you use the modern biology methods to see if we can replicate this or even improve upon it. So we're looking for better enzymes, in fact, ultimately microbes that will take a slight carrying charge and pass the rest on to us, except without the termite. This field is called synthetic biology, where you're going to put into the microbes not just one gene, but a set of genes. It's an extension of the kind of biology used to create many of today's drugs in companies like Genentech. There was a cure for malaria found in an extract of a plant grown in Asia called artemisinin, and Jay Kiesling, who's the Division Director of Physical Biosciences at Berkeley Lab and also a professor of chemical engineering and chemistry at Berkeley, has taught E. coli how to produce this artemisinin precursor. So these are little bugs that a lot of the pharmaceutical companies also use to produce drugs. But there's a pathway and a set of proteins that he's induced to make these guys produce this drug. This is a very important issue because malaria kills about 1.5 million people a year. It was anticipated that would increase rapidly because the protozoa that transmits the malaria from person to person has become resistant to quinine-based drugs. That's Jay Kiesling, just in case you want to see him walking around the streets. This work has got the attention of the Gates Foundation. And so the Gates Foundation has invested $42 million to help Jay finish up the work in his lab and to begin a new startup company. These are the milestones for this new startup company. These are the arrows are when they met the milestones. They're on schedule, on target, and they hope to deliver a cure for this malaria, 20 cents a cure. The startup company, the contract of the startup company was it would have to develop this and supply it to One World Health, which would distribute it at cost. But what's in it for the startup company is any intellectual know-how that they gained along the way, they can keep as their own. And if they can apply it to anything else, that's their business. So Amyris has got its first round of venture capital funding because the bugs that make this drug can also be used potentially to make a biofuel. And so this is a one pathway where you want a replacement for yeast. So something that munches on either simple or even complex sugars, and it creates a biofuel directly, and ideally one that self-separates from water, like oil and water don't mix. And so that's one of the hopes, is that this type of technology can be useful for that. This is an aerial view of our lab, a very recent picture. Here's our famous stadium. And this is, oops, I just made it. This slide, and it's, the heck with it. This little circle should be down in this bare patch of grass. We're planning on building a building that would be housing a lot of the energy storage, the solar photovoltaic, and the BP work, this biofuels work. It's in a little spot over here in adjacent to some nanotechnology building and some material science buildings. We are been doing some fundraising for a lot of this Helios work. The Helios is the big umbrella project that is both photovoltaics, energy storage, new electrochemistry, biofuels, and you can actually add to that things like rejuvenated energy efficiencies, things of that nature. So BP has picked Berkeley and the Berkeley Lab in Illinois, and that's that. We've got, so far, $15 million in private donations to help build the building. The state of California, it's now in the governor's budget. It has to be passed by the Assembly and State Senate, but $70 million to help build the building and some bonding authority. We've raised $4 million in private funds to start energy research while the DOE builds up to start to fund this stuff. And we're looking for more donors for the building, another $15 million or so. So in case you want to talk to me afterwards regarding that, I'll be glad to listen. And the Department of Energy, we've also applied for a $125 million grant over 5 years. And we'll hopefully get maybe a couple of million, but grow to $20 million a year for the solar part. We are trying to partner with industry, even if they don't give us this kind of money. But because this can't be done in the usual academic way of doing research, where you publish some papers, maybe file for some patents, and then that's it. Industry is very good about knowing how to think scale to industrial strength. And for example, BP, they know chemical engineering very well, and they know things about biorefineries that we would not know about, even though they haven't built biorefineries, because they know so much about oil refineries. And from us, they want to learn biology. So industrial partners on the solar photovoltaic side and other things would also be desirable, because we want to get this out into the marketplace as quickly as possible. The way we want to do it is very reminiscent of the way Bell Laboratories introduced technology. This is the main laboratory of Bell Laboratories. I worked at Bell Labs for 9 years. I worked at this branch for five. Used to live in a house right here. Hop the fence, walk to work. It was probably the most enjoyable part of my scientific life, in the sense that after I became a postdoc here, I was made an assistant professor at Berkeley, but I didn't teach a class. They let me take a leave of absence to go here for 2 years, which I did. Stayed, unfortunately, a little longer. And so stayed nine, then went to Stanford, but I came back 25 years later. Bell Laboratories is another very distinguished laboratory. 15 of the scientists who worked there earned Nobel Prizes. When I was hired in the late 70s, there were 30, 40 of us who were in this area of the building, in the basic research area, we had more or less free license to do many, many things that we could pick from, or actually choose, in my case, at carte blanche. Five of us have Nobel Prizes, and we were all hired as young kids, either fresh out of graduate school or as just finishing a postdoc. We weren't hired as established scientists. And half of those 40 or so are members in the National Academy. So this place grew all of its scientists, not just some of them, they grew every one. It's an amazing place. It led to many amazing inventions. This is, believe it or not, the first transistor. It invented the laser, it invented information theory. Bell Labs invented many, many things that we take for granted today. In the invention of this laser, one could think of the people who got the Nobel Prize for the invention of the laser, Shockley, Brittain, and Bardeen. But in actual fact, the full story is that there had to be fundamental developments in material science. There had to be fundamental understanding of how electrons actually moved around in semiconductors and the surface states and what happened when you put two different semiconductors together, both positively and negatively doped. So Bell Labs discovered or rediscovered, depending on your point of view, the fact that when you put two semiconductors together, electricity would only go one way. That was done in 1939, 1940. And once you have that action, if they thought if you can have another thin layer of semiconductor material, you can actually modulate the current that went this one way, so you can actually control it. So by a little input in this third thing, you can actually make an amplifier or an electronic switch, just as you had with a diode vacuum tube or a triode vacuum tube. And so they set about, said, we need this because the vacuum tube is not going to be, in the future, it's not going to satisfy our needs for long-distance transmission, amplification, and switching. It took them 9 years from the time they discovered its diode action by the time they announced the invention of the transistor. This would not have been done that fast in academic research. And in those 9 years and the following 10 years, they laid a lot of the foundations of the semiconductor industry, the theoretical foundations that saw us through the rest of that century. So it's that kind of work that we need to do in the energy domain in these various areas. Berkeley Lab actually has a tradition of putting together teams of brilliant scientists. This is an early picture of Ernest Lawrence, the founder of Berkeley Lab, with some of his colleagues. And the first five of his colleagues, all young people, the first five people got Nobel Prizes, and you might recognize some of the others. And if you were a physicist, you would recognize 95% of these people. Now, this idea of team science, of brilliant genius actually working together, is a tradition that's continued in high-energy physics at the Berkeley Lab. For example, this last year's Nobel Prize in Physics awarded to George Smoot and John Mather. George came to Berkeley Space Science Center and then LBNL as a young postdoc and became the leader of this team that helped earn the Nobel Prize when he was about 31, 32. And a similar discovery of a similar in the sense of great importance was led by Sol Perlmutter, who discovered that after the Big Bang, birth of the observable universe, the stuff is receding. But since all matter and energy gravitationally attract, you expect as the stuff expands, it slows up because there's forces pulling it back together again. And what Sol found when he tried to measure this expansion more accurately is it wasn't slowing up. It got the wrong sign. It was speeding up. No matter or energy would ever make it speed up. He wisely called this dark energy because it was funded by the Department of Energy. In 2006, he got a $1 million prize, shared a $1 million prize, a short prize and an Italian prize alone. So these teams are part of the DNA. Again, he led this team in his early 30s. So if you look at the laboratories, or if you look at other multidisciplinary projects, from the Manhattan Project to the invention of radar to a lot of things, you find that they shared a lot of things, that individual genius is nurtured, but those individuals were really encouraged to form very quickly a team to rapidly exploit an idea that could go much faster beyond just the workings of a single principal investigator. That in order to do this, the managers, if you will, it's better that people like Oppenheimer or Fermi and others were the managers, because they can actually say, okay, this is a great idea. We can put our resources there. And so it is very important that the managers actually be good scientists, and that you actually begin to back the people. You don't back the idea. The reason you want to back people is because if they're really good, they will attack the hardest problems first, and so failure is expected, but you fail fast and you get on with it and you try the next good idea, or there'd be a list of ideas. And this again is unlike most academic funding, where you have to have a steady stream of publishable things so you can get funded in the next round. So survival dictates that you be more conservative, but if it's managed in this way, maybe we can get to the answer more quickly. So this is the idea that we're going to have going forward in this energy research in the various areas, biofuels, photovoltaics, and others. I think it's important. We would like to keep the climate more or less the same, especially in the Bay Area. And we'd also like to keep some of the lights on. So thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Chu. We will take some questions. We have microphones on either side of the midsection of the theater, and we encourage you to come to the microphone to ask questions. We'll alternate, and we'll plan to end promptly at 7 p.m. Steve, do you want to call on them alternately, one side to the other?
Yeah, are you going to do it? You
go ahead.
Yep, sure.
Okay. We have people. Can you see? Could
no
we
one
dim
that, so
the lights just a little so
okay.
We can see out into the sure. audience? Yeah.
There's only one microphone being used. So.
Well, with the burning of fuels, aren't we just promoting more global warming? In the newspapers, it said that ozone is going to be worse with biofuels, and food prices are going up. I guess, well, you're talking about other synthetic fuels other than fuel, but with the corn thing, fuel prices, a lot of feeds for animal stocks and fuels come from foods, and foods are being producers of energy are starting to vie with food producers for food, and with places like Darfur turning our food stocks into fuel while people are starving in Darfur seems like the ultimate sin. And meanwhile, the Mini Cooper said they're coming out in 2008 with an electric car, and I've been telling people to plug their hybrid electric cars into their solar electric rooftops. It's time to put your solar electric rooftops in place, both residential and communities, and get ready for the plug-in hybrids and also the electric cars. And I think that's coming down in price, and also that'll make the rooftop installation have to pay back in about 4 years instead of eight if you're pumping sunshine instead of Chevron. So the question is, don't you think that the market will go that way and solar and all that'll come really down, and therefore biofuels will actually be more expensive and lose out in the long run? Thank you.
Okay, so there were... I guess the question is, don't you think that biofuels won't be an answer and that solar will be the solution? Was that the question?
Well, in the long run, I think if we place solar panels on every rooftop in California and okay. also solar the desert, these solar intensive generation plants, that yes, it will
okay.
eventually
so
solve
let
the
me
problem.
Make a few remarks. First, the reason people in the world are starving actually has not that much to do with the world ability to produce food. It has to do with economic and wealth distribution. Okay, and so that's point number one. Point number two is that I got to see this firsthand by serving on this International Committee for Energy. There are a lot of people in Africa, India, and other places where they want to use a lot of marginal land, or land that is now not being used for anything, that's being picked over by essentially children, scavenging for fuel to cook and to heat, where they would like to produce something that grows on very little water and no fertilizer, so they can substitute for this foraging where the land has actually been picked clean. It's been deforested already and things of that nature. So now the world economic distribution problem is an issue that I'll recognize that's an issue. But it is not as though we will be making people starve in order to make biofuels, especially, and corn is at best a transition. We want to get off corn as quickly as possible. It is not the right crop. I mean, we're talking about a factor of 10 improvement. And once you're talking about a factor of 10, that really means using surplus land and not driving up food prices by a lot or really appreciably. So the other thing is biofuels, at best, will be probably a 15% impact on the world energy. Okay? It happens because, why do I say that? The United States total energy for petroleum is 28% for transportation fuels. We can probably replace two-thirds of that in the short term. Why not all of it? It's because we don't know how to make airplane fuel and diesel fuel yet in an economic way. So the grasses that I'm talking about could be, and the bio waste could be the gasoline substitution. And the world uses 24-25%. So let's talk about half at best. Okay? So it's not that much. Why is it so important? It's because it really does define the geopolitical sands of many countries. And because of these hundreds of billions of dollars that we're spending. But I also outlined baseload electricity generation as even a higher priority for the world. And so it's not that we're only working on biofuels. We would love it if the federal government or some gazillionaire out there would give us money to do all these other things that we've outlined, and we're busily trying to convince the federal government to do this. So electricity generation is very, very different than petroleum use. We don't use petroleum anymore for generating electricity. It's just too valuable. It's used for transportation and plastics. And we can get substitutes for those. So I think in the long run, I think we will have a solution. But it better be in the shorter run. It better be by mid-century, quite frankly.
Thank you. My research tells me that there's one plant that stands head and shoulders above all other biomass fuel sources that hasn't been mentioned yet. And it's in terms of efficiency and in terms of being clean burning. And this is good old-fashioned industrial hemp, H-E-M-P. Marijuana's non-psychoactive cousin. Just visualize for a moment that it's legal. You're a hemp farmer. You've just sold your crop to a fuel processor who probably makes it into one of the 50,000 products made in the world today from hemp. You return home. You notice there's some residue left on the ground. You sweep that up and sell it the next day to a biofuels firm. And you sit back with a smug expression on your face. Realize
no, I'm
you
not.
Should be quite happy because one,
you're not the first.
None of it was wasted, and two, it made good money. Now, then you muse about history a little bit in 1869 and Rudolf Diesel and the biomass and so on. But the problem today is the legal thing. Your job is to do the research, and I like your outline. Our job is, in my case, I've made a presentation like that on hemp.
Okay, free. So
we're reintroducing the bill from last year, this year also, and Arnold's with us more this year.
So actually, you're not the first person that mentioned hemp to me, and I don't know if it is the only thing. I actually didn't even know it was illegal, so it shows you how much I know. But it's not clear it is the best crop. I think we should look at all crops. Also, people have said with equal certainty bamboo is the best one, sweet potatoes are the best one, and so on down the line. In actual fact, there is no best one, and that you should remember that. It depends on the climate and the local water supply and sunlight and everything else. And so that's something where we're not looking for a single plant. In fact, that would be wrong for a lot of reasons. Not to look for a single plant. So I think you're about the fourth person. I, for whatever reason, the real experts, the plant guys, don't really mention hemp. And I don't think, but I'll go and prod them some more as to whether it's only because it's illegal. There may be other situations. So you know, it's not. I was smiling. Because it was about the fourth time it was mentioned that hemp was the answer. And, you know, it may be the answer.
Are you on? Come around the other side, then we'll take you over there.
Is it harder?
I think I could talk.
Okay.
I've read in the Department of News, Department of Energy news website that plug-in hybrid energy vehicles could be used widely while being plugged in at an off-peak time. So what are the sort of perspectives and limitations on those in your point of view?
I think plug-in hybrids are great. And the only thing that's keeping them now is just the battery technology is not quite there. It's just like solar photovoltaics are great. The only thing keeping them there now is that the cost issue is not there yet. I think once you get to a battery which can take enough discharge, deep discharges, so that it could survive for, of scale, 10 years, then you've really got something, even at 100-mile range. Because that's where most driving is less than 100 miles. Right now, the Prius battery, for example, is maintained at between 40 and 60% of charge. Systems keep it there because if you took the battery and just discharged it completely, you'd kill it in a bunch of discharges. Just like the battery in this, which I do discharge, after a year, it's lost its poop. So you don't want to do this for, $5,000, $10,000 worth of batteries. After 1 year, you can only go 30 miles. So there are possibilities. There may be a possibility, actually, that has come out of Berkeley Lab and University of California, Berkeley. We patented it. We licensed it to a venture capital firm. It's going to require tens of millions of dollars to see if it'll work. But it has potential for increasing the storage capacity by about a factor of 3. And it is already shown that it can be cycled a million times. It could fail as well, just like everything else. But I think the research into battery technology is great because it's really good because you plug in at night. And so those energy sources that are standing idle can be used. Remember that use it or lose it part of electricity. If you have a fossil fuel plant, you can make it go up and down. But in other situations, especially nuclear power, you don't want to power down at all. Because fuel costs nothing. It's only the cost of money that really matters. So so that type of thing, I'm very hopeful we can get in the marketplace within 5 years. Not only this invention, but there are other rumors I hear about that might come to pass. So plug-in hybrids is a big deal. It's a big deal for a lot of things because it shifts petroleum, again, the most valuable form of energy to electricity, where your options widen. And so that's also very important. Your options to generate clean energy are much broader.
Yeah. Hi, Mr. Chu. First of all, I'd like to say that I have great respect for your work, and I hope to see it funded very generously in the future. You seem to have a dark vision that I'm sort of seeing around the outskirts of your talk today, which is that there's a possibility in the future of energy wars. We have so many ideological conflicts going in the world, and if we add to that, China and India and Russia all polluting, and the kinds of tensions that could create. I'm wondering, though, why you didn't mention fusion, which was the first thing at the top of your list. I applaud you for making somewhat of a case for fission. I know that, for instance, in France, fission is a large part of their electrical energy. I think that's true in most of Europe. I also know that there's a lot of research going on in the world with fusion. Is it possibly because Lawrence Livermore Labs are the fission guys, and you're a little bit competitive with them? But
no.
Make the case, if you would, for fission. I know that out at Livermore they have the the 192 lasers focused on the on the chamber out there. And unfortunately, I think, is it not true that they use it more for weapons work than they do for energy work?
Okay, so the reason I didn't mention fusion is because even the biggest proponents of fusion research, people actually doing it, say that right now the plan is that there's an international collaboration to build a magnetic confinement fusion reactor in the south of France that's going to be between $5 and $10 billion experiment, just to show that you can scale this up and we understand enough about it and we can keep it burning for hundreds of seconds. If that works well, and might have a dozen year lifetime and half a dozen years to build, then there's another follow-up on that called DEMO. I'm not sure what DEMO stands for. Another 10-year thing where you might actually begin to, it's the kind of the pre-pilot plant. Now you're into 2060. And the most optimistic proponents of this say that you actually begin to put it online in the last quarter of the century, and then it would grow. Now, you have to understand that it's still an experimental stage. We don't even know technically if it's going to work. There are problems that we actually know about, and we don't know how to solve them today. One problem is the neutron damage, that the fusion reactors in the future, if they're ever going to work, have such a high flux of neutrons that actually go into metals. They make helium inclusions. The metal just completely falls apart. So right now the plan is there's a lithium blank that absorbs most of the neutrons. So you convert the lithium to fuel. That's good. But then the outer metal container of this $10 billion thing ruptures after about a year and a half. That's not commercially viable. So the current plan is to put a layer of metal there that was replaced every year and a half to protect it from the real vacuum chamber. But that's also not commercially viable, quite frankly, because the stuff is radioactive, the metal. It's been neutron activated. You have to shut down the whole thing, replace it, put it up. So that materials problem is one of the issues that we're concerned about. So I didn't mention it only because it's not going to play an important role in certainly the first two-thirds of this century.
But the European system is the confinement, and out in Livermore, they're bombarding the
capsules.
Okay,
that's a different thing. That's this laser inertial confinement.
Yeah. Sure.
And that is not commercially viable either, and whether it was, initially it was funded as for weapons. It was not really weapons, but you're not going to make a bomb with this thing. But you actually make a burst of radiation and intense gamma rays and things like that, so you can see if electronics, like in satellites, could withstand something that would mimic a mini H-bomb. Okay, so that is very also very very far away from commercial realization. You've got to understand that money is ultimately driving this stuff. If Americans wanted to triple their energy, we could transition to clean energy. We can transition photovoltaics today. If you triple your energy, what you want to pay for electricity, okay? So that's the thing. Money is driving it. And so it's not, you know, I mentioned a lot of things we aren't doing. We're not doing wind. I'm a big fan of wind. And so it has nothing to do with rivalry with Livermore. Is that working now?
I don't think so. I just wanted to...
Yes.
Yeah, it's working.
It is?
Yes.
I just wanted to ask you why it seemed to me that your impression of nuclear waste wasn't such a big deal. And also the second question is you didn't mention anything, although you had it listed, about hydrogen.
Okay. No, I said nuclear waste is an unsolved problem. It is a big deal. The waste from coal burning is worse, in my mind. And I just wanted to make that clear. It may not seem as scary because maybe we're used to burning coal more, but in terms of killing people and things like that, coal is far deadlier. There is a possibility for greatly reducing the waste of nuclear fission by having a small fraction, about 20-25% of the fission reactors, use a fast spectrum, high-energy neutrons. And what that does is it burns down the long-lived waste to much shorter-lived waste, and it also converts some of it to fuel, quite frankly, which can be used in the standard fission reactors. That technology is not deployable today because it's the generation of nuclear reactors that are now being designed are much, much safer than the ones of old, but that new technology of the fast neutrons is less safe. And so before we go to those so-called fast neutron reactors, we need to do a lot more research if we're ever going to go there. The waste is an issue. And we see it today because the citizens of Utah are determined not to have this stored in their backyard. Nevada, sorry. just as I'm sure there will be a lot of citizens who don't want carbon dioxide stored anywhere near them. Okay? So it's one of those things where right now we have, in terms of current baseload electricity generation, we have coal and we have nuclear, but actually nuclear won't be a major factor no matter what because of the money issue. Coal is the default option because the utility companies are much more familiar with building coal plants. There's much less financial risk. There's all sorts of reasons why we are defaulting to coal. And we're now 20% nuclear in the United States. It will go down, I think. France is about 78% fission. They can probably keep it up there. But I think we will probably default to coal unless something really dramatic happens. And then all the other things I talked about will come true, that's why I'm so scared of coal. It's the economics, the pollution, the everything. So it's not like I'm really for nuclear. It's like it's the lesser of two evils for this century or for the first half of two-thirds of this century. And then hopefully we get off of that as quickly as possible. And I would hope that fusion in the next century would be.
The second part of her question was about hydrogen.
Yes, hydrogen. Hydrogen is a form of transferring one type of energy to another. You don't drill for hydrogen. And so the two sources of hydrogen that we have are either you can transform coal into hydrogen, but if you do that and you don't sequester the coal, the carbon dioxide, you're also losing a factor of 2, 2.5 of the energy content of the coal by transforming to hydrogen. So once you've got the hydrogen and burn the hydrogen, that's great. You make water, very clean. But all the pollutants and everything else are still there if you took it from coal. The other possibility is you actually use a nuclear power plant to convert electricity to hydrogen at the off hours, like at night. And you store it on site. And not to pump it around, you know, for transportation. That's probably the last application I foresee. But just store it on site, in some big bag. The reason that's good is because there's a lot of security in a nuclear power plant already. And so it's easier to protect against an explosion and mishap and sabotage around a nuclear power plant than many other places. So that you use the electricity for electrolysis, which is in itself not that efficient. And so we are looking, as part of our research, to how do you convert, use electricity to make hydrogen or some other hydrocarbon so that you can convert back to electricity on demand. So that's part of the thing, because the conversion process of electricity to hydrogen and then back again is not economically viable yet. So hydrogen will be good if we can get that process going. But it's just a shifting the form of energy from one form to another is what hydrogen really is.
Steve, we should take one more question.
Okay. Yeah, as the founding president of North America Taiwanese Engineer Association, I'm very honored to come to listen to your distinguished speech all the way from South Bay, San Jose area. I have a very simple question I'd like to ask you. One of your slides showing, you know, California state has a much better the energy conservation or energy efficiency than the rest of the country. This is because California has a better climate condition or has a better energy policy or both, something like that?
It's a better energy policy. We had for a while the best insulation standards in the country. It's really strictly a better energy policy. Some of the northeastern states, New York, for example, are catching up and are also very energy efficient compared to some of the other states. I think Texas is, yes, someone mentioned Texas. Texas, the cost of electricity in Texas is about 5.5 cents a kilowatt hour. And with those prices, you know, price is actually a huge determinant. Just so you guys know, there is one country that I know of in the world where unsubsidized solar photovoltaics work, Japan. It's about 30, 35 cents a kilowatt hour. Don't need a subsidy. Okay?
Thank you.